the early history of supersymmetry started in the 1970s with its discoveries, and at the beginning it was essentially made because of quantum field theory, from the quantum field theory point of view, not so much for particle physics. You might also know that there has been a theorem which showed that things like supersymmetry cannot exist, and of course that made it much more exciting when people constructed it. In the beginning it started with the Vesomino model and Gates theories, the superspace formalism, and it also turned out that breaking supersymmetry was not so easy. So some people actually thought that supersymmetry is such a nice theory that you would not be able to break it spontaneously. But then there were two types of models which led to the breakdown, the Fayer-Yoplos model and also the O'Rafferty model. The first one we would call D-term Suzy breaking, and the second one F-term Suzy breaking. I guess I don't have to explain to you what F and D-terms are, since we are at the Suzy conference. And also, pretty soon, local supersymmetry was discovered, which is another name for supergravity. In particle physics, there were pretty few attempts around that time. Fayer was one of the pioneers in the framework of D-term Suzy breakdown, and it was not so easy to construct models. At the same time, in fact, grand unified theories in the mid-70s had been discussed, and there they emphasized there was this question of a hierarchy of two scales, the Planck scale and the weak scale, which got more pronounced even, because here we now had the gut scale of something like 10 to the 15 GeV, large compared to weak scale, and there was this notion of the hierarchy problem. Solutions, early solutions of the hierarchy problem actually did not even consider these grand unified theories, but they tried to solve it in terms like Technicolor theories. A way to keep grand unification and supersymmetry was given by supersymmetry. And supersymmetry entered the game because of the non-renormalization theorems which made this hierarchy stable, and also because of the possibility of dynamical supersymmetry breakdown, so we could actually get the small scale bidimensional transmutation. So that was actually when the things started really to go fast in the early 1980s. Early attempts in model building, spontaneous breakdown of Suzy, turned out to be difficult because of some obstacles which appeared and which I'll discuss in a moment. So there had been some early work at Stanford at that time and at Princeton. Let me define now where we started. We take the MSSM, the minimal supersymmetric standard model, as the model with the minimal particle content. So what we have for the quarks and the partners, we have chiral superfields. Q is a doublet of SU2, UD are singlets of SU2. Then we have leptons, L, E, for the leptons and the partners. And we have two Higgs supermultiplets, which are also chiral superfields. The superpotential, which is allowed by all of the symmetries, is the superpotential which gives us the Yukawa couplings, QHD, the down quark Yukawa couplings, QH bar U, the up quark Yukawa couplings, and LHE, which gives mass to the leptons. In addition, we can write the so-called new term, which is an HH bar mass term. It is allowed by supersymmetry. The symmetries would also allow couplings, which are denoted here in red, and then some of them come from the fact that in the MSSM, compared to the standard model, you cannot distinguish between a lepton and a Higgs. In the standard model, the lepton is a fermion, whereas the Higgs is a boson. Now, in supersymmetry, both of them are chiral superfields, so there's no distinction. So there are additional terms which are written here in red, and they are problematic. because they will lead to baryon and lepton number violation, and they might lead to fast proton. So that's something we'll come back to discussing. Given the fact that it was difficult to set up a theory with spontaneous supersymmetry, the idea came up to consider a version of supersymmetry where we had an explicit breakdown of supersymmetry, but in such a way that the breakdown terms are soft. So the ultraviolet properties, the stability of the theory was guaranteed still, and one postpones the idea of getting a good explanation for the soft breaking terms. Now, at that point, this scheme led to two predictions. It led to two problems, and in addition, if one would like to understand the origin of the soft supersymmetry breakdown terms, there remain four obstacles to be removed. So I will now discuss first the two predictions, then I will discuss the two problems, and then I will go somewhat in for the four obstacles, because I think that's still something which is relevant today, and which you should keep in mind. So let's start with the predictions. The first prediction has to do with the evolution of the gauge coupling constant. It led to a situation that the grand unified theory, MGUT, is raised by an order of magnitude, and that sine squared theta W is 0.23 at that time. And I guess the first paper which discussed that was by Imoglu, Swaby, and Wilshoff. Now at that time, not so good predictions, actually, because when you would have asked somebody what is sine squared theta w, you would have told it's 0.20, not 0.23, which actually is a big difference. So, and also, around that time, there was still the hope, and there were some rumors that proton decay had been seen already, and that would have meant that the theory here with an MGUT raised by an order of magnitude, which makes the proton lifetime, at least naively, smaller by four orders of magnitude, longer than four orders of magnitude, was not the best prediction. But of course, now we know that this is one of the things in supersymmetry which still keep us going. Another prediction was that there is an upper bound on the mass of the lightest Higgs. And this comes from the fact that when you look at this theory, this lambda phi to the 4 self-coupling, which we have in the standard model, here is not an independent quantity, but is a quantity which is given by the gauge coupling constant, and that's defined. At 3 level, this means that the mass of the lightest Higgs is less than the set mass, and with radiative corrections, mainly due to the top quark Yukawa coupling. Nowadays, we know that for top quark Yukawa coupling of 175 or 170 GeV, the Higgs mass bound is 130 GeV. And I think that's still something very relevant for searches for supersymmetry. If one goes beyond the MSSM, for example, to the N-MSSM, which has singlet in addition to it, one can raise that bound because one has an additional singlet. But even there, it's not possible to do that at will. So you will have to keep, in the simplest form, supersymmetry will favor a light Higgs boson, light in the sense at T. So these were the two predictions. The two problems were, one of them is the celebrated mu problem. Mu HH bar is allowed by supersymmetry. And you might ask the question, why is mu not large? It could be as large as the gut scale, and so you have to make it small. Now you might invent symmetries or something else to make it small or zero, but then you would have to ask the question, why does it have the value it needs to have? Because it has to have a value which is comparable to the soft supersymmetric mass term for the model to make sense, given an order of magnitude. So that's the mu problem, and a lot of discussion about the mu problem is around. I will not discuss this in details, but that's the problem. The second, which I mentioned already, we have to distinguish between the L and the H to avoid fast proton decay. That means the three terms which I mentioned before, the UDD, QLD, and LNE, have to be forbidden. And so that can be done by a symmetry, and we can actually invoke a discrete R symmetry, which does that. So this is, as I said, a problem, because we have to do something which in the standard model we get for free. Here we do it with R parity, but at the end we were very happy about it, because this actually turns into a nice property of the model, because it means that the supersymmetric particle have a new quantum number. They are produced in pairs. That's not so good, because it's more difficult to produce them. But, of course, the most important thing is that there is a stable particle. The lightest of these R parity odd particles is stable, and it's now considered of one of the prime dark matter candidates, which we know. So these were the two problems. Now let me come to the four obstacles for model building, which I think are still relevant today, and they have, actually some of them have been forgotten and rediscovered several times. The first one is that for F-term supersymmetry breaking, there was a rule that supertrace at tree level, supertrace of M squared is equal to zero, which means the supersymmetric, the supertrace is the difference of the bosons and the fermions. So this is the difference of the mass squared of the bosons and the fermions. Of course, this vanishes when supersymmetry is exact, because you have the partners with the same mass. When you break supersymmetry, it could become non-zero. But here, at tree level, it remains zero, which means when you move, so you have, let's look at the electron mass, and you want to move up the electron partner. If you move one up, you have to move another down. That means some, if something is heavier than the electron, something else has to pay for it and become lighter. So that's an obstacle, which has. So we can now say, well, you see, we need radiative corrections, or we need D-term Susie breaking, or whatever. It's an obstacle. I will not go so much into detail. The second one is that in principle, the Gaugino masses at tree level are non-renormalizable, because when we try to construct them from, let's say, an F or D term, which are dimension 2, then the fermion bilinear B dimension 3, we have a dimension 5 term. So Gaugino masses vanish at tree level. And also there, it means that we need something like radiative corrections or something else that gives us non-trivial Gaugino masses. It could be that we have non-renormalizable terms which do it. The same is true for the first term, because the supertrace of M squared was for the renormalizable field. The third problem, and that might be actually related to the second one, is that when we take the standard, when we take the MSSM, the particle content of the MSSM, without the soft breaking terms, in fact, and we demand an R parity, a discrete R parity, there is actually a bigger symmetry. This R parity, in some way, becomes a continuous R symmetry. That field. Now that is something bad, because if you would break the R symmetry spontaneously down to the R parity, it would lead to a situation that you get an axiom. And since there's a QCD anomaly involved, this is really a bad axiom, this QCD axiom, and that's something which you cannot tolerate. So something has to be done here. In any case, there has to be done something, because you should also allow Gaugino masses, because that symmetry would forbid the Gaugino. So you have to get something, you have to get an explicit breakdown of that symmetry, which you see was created in some way by getting a stable program. So that's something which also is a problem. The last one is an obvious problem. In supersymmetry, you know all that when supersymmetry, global supersymmetry is broken, that the vacuum energy is positive and non-zero, and that's of the size of the supersymmetry breaking term. So that's something which you have to look at. And fortunately, we have learned that in the framework of supergravity, that's no longer true. You can have broken supergravity, but a vanishing cosmological constant. We don't yet understand why the cosmological constant vanishes. Supersymmetry is not enough for that. But at least we know how to fine-tune the vacuum. So what we, in a certain way, need is that we have to break supersymmetry somewhere in a sector which is far away, not too close to the MXSM. So we have to either have a weakly coupled hidden sector, so a hidden sector which breaks supersymmetry, and then you get radiative corrections, which lead to the soft breaking terms, or you, well, in any case, we also need supergravity, so you could have some hidden sector which in some way is remote, and it breaks supersymmetry, and you get reasonable soft terms. So this is, so there has been a lot of model constructions around that time, and in fact, it turned out that when one considered supergravity and the scheme, which is called gravity mediation, all these obstacles could be solved. So one has the MSSM as the observable sector, one has a hidden sector that breaks supersymmetry spontaneously, and this is a remote sector. It's a hidden sector, it only communicates to the observable sector via gravitation. There, actually, it could show that the supertrace of M squared is non-zero, things can be raised, the vacuum energy can be broken, the R-symmetry, the continuous R-symmetry does not exist, and the Galgino masses come in supergravitational terms, in the supergravity action, as dimension 5 operators, suppressed by the Planck mass. But nonetheless, one could solve these four obstacles. That happened in 1982, and one could actually set up the theory, compute the soft breaking terms, and one, the scale, in some way, of the soft supersymmetry breaking terms was set by the Gravitino mass, which was an F term divided by M Planck, or which, in the case of dynamical proton supersymmetry for new interactions, it was lambda cube over M Planck squared. And the soft mass terms we got in such a scheme are mass terms M0 for the scalars, M a half for the Galginos, and these parameters A and B for the trilinear and bilinear terms in the super in the soft terms masses. So this scheme actually, when this came, in fact, people dropped other ways of trying to break supersymmetry, at least for 10 years. So what is now known as gauge mediation or so, that is something which was done before. It was not particularly successful because of these obstacles, and at the given time around that, people stopped doing it. Some 10 years later, people revived this, and that's why we are still talking about it today. Now with these developments, in fact, successful model building was possible all of a sudden. A lot of things could be asked now. Flavor symmetries, CP violation, and all these things. And it is actually a wider fraction of theoretical physicists became optimistic concerning the realization of SUSY. So there was a kind of boom around that time, people taking supersymmetric seriously and thinking that it might have something to do with nature. Before, supersymmetry or this model building by some people was not considered as physics. It was considered as some theoretical strange objects where some theorists work on because they don't know what physics is. Well, maybe these people were right. So, in fact, in 1983, in fact, when I wrote this article in Physics Report in the introduction, sometimes people remind me of that sentence that I said there. Experiments within the next 5 to 10 years will enable us to decide whether supersymmetry at the weak interaction scale is a myth or reality. So this is what I said around that time in 1984. And that was a long time ago because I remember now that was actually the first time when I visited this country, and I still remember it very well. And the good thing about this statement is it's still true. Whatever that means. But you see, we had been optimistic, and of course at that time, the optimism came from the fact that we were waiting for LEP, but I come back to that in a moment, because in between there was something which actually supported the picture very much, and this was the string revolution around the time in 84, 85. There was this heterodic string theory which had E8 cross E8, a hidden and a several sector, so you could use one of the sectors to get the standard model and the second to break supersymmetry, and actually there was a natural way of breaking supersymmetry by Gay-Jino condensation, and that fitted the scheme exactly. So all what we had learned from the bottom-up approach was given here. And as you might remember, or those might remember who were already in the game at that time, of course there was much more hope. Some people said that physics will be solved in a few years after the invent of string theory. That's also a statement which is still true today. So it's actually here that also a new variant of gravity mediation emerged, and it has to do with the fields which we get in this super string theory, which are these moduli fields like the dilaton or the size moduli of the mass. So LEP was of course something which was supposed to give us all we wanted to know about physics beyond the standard model. So it started in September 1989, and we were very excited. And the first stage of LEP, so LEP 1 sitting at the set peak, gave us no direct signal for supersymmetry. That was not too bad because the reach sitting at 90 GeV, the reach in mass was not that large. It gave us, however, an indirect sign from the evolution of gauge coupling constant. And it gave us also the resurrection of Susikas. So I'll show you the plots. I guess these are the plots as they appeared in the CERN Korea in 1990 from the Delphi experiment. So that was the supersymmetric. This was the evolution of the coupling constant, the supersymmetric model, and that's in the non-supersymmetric model. And you see clearly, it's clear that this was a good sign for the MSSM evolution, but of course it's an indirect sign. But in fact, a large fraction of the community got excited about supersymmetry at that time, and that also included experimentals. All was set for the discovery of LEP 2. So we hoped LEP 2 would solve the problem, but the answer for LEP 2 was not clear. Now you might also see, when you heard before, that this is the 16th conference on SUSY. It actually started in 1993, so it only started around that time, and I think time was ripe for having a SUSY conference, because there had been before a conference on grand unification, and people got frustrated at a given point, so that at the end of the 80s they terminated these conference series and had a conference which was called the last workshop on grand unification. So now, since that time, since 1993, we have this conference, SUSY series. So these pictures you have seen already. So LEP 2. LEP 2 was running, and LEP 2 in some way was covering a large part of the parameter space. Yeah, it had 200 GeV, so you could actually produce charging noise up to a mass of 100 GeV. And that was something which one could have hoped would be around. Well, LEP 2, of course, gave us further support for grand unification, the evolution of the coupling constant. It gave us a Higgs mass bound, which is bigger than 114 GeV. And it gave us a lot of electroweak precision data, which was consistent with the standard model. And did not necessarily require supersymmetry. I'll come back to that point. The electroweak precision data preferred the rather low Higgs mass, which, as we had seen, is something that would be good for supersymmetry. So not everything is bad. There's no direct sign for SUSY, but there was an encouragement, at least for some people. At least it means not everything is lost. Let's go on. What we have to admit or say at that point is that a large part of the parameter space of supersymmetry was gone. because it had been checked and nothing was found. And by definition, this parameter space is the parameter space which favors low mass SUSY particles. So what we can say in some way that we are living in a corner of parameter space, that the SUSY partners are a bit heavier than naively we would have expected, but nothing is really wrong yet. This is that we live in a parameter space, sometimes is called the little hierarchy problem. Come back later to that. But it's a question whether one calls that a problem. No decision has been given by them too. The game is still on. So you can ask the question, if you are enthusiastic about SUSY, what actually keeps us going? Of course, there's still this unification of the coupling constant. There's the argument that in any case, something has to be there beyond the standard model for dark matter. And supersymmetry had a good dark matter candidate from the early time. The electroweak precision data is consistent with supersymmetry. Actually, supersymmetry is a very mild change from the standard model. And in fact, you see the direct bounds on supersymmetry are much stronger than the bounds which you get from this more indirect precision data. There's G minus 2, which is inconsistent with the standard model, could be explained in supersymmetry and could be used as a hint. But of course, this is rather weak. Could be other ways of doing it. I think the thing which a lot of people keeps us going is that alternatives to supersymmetry usually have problems with some of them. Very often they have problems with the unification of coupling constant. They only do at physics and GEV. They have no ultraviolet completion. They also have sometimes problems with the electroweak precision data because there are bigger deviations. In supersymmetry, also, one should say that R-parity is one of the reasons why this there's not so much problem with electroweak precision data, because you have to do everything in loops, you have to create new particles in pairs, so there's not so much problem. So now, of course, LEP is gone since a long time, and we have done a lot of things, and now what we have at the moment is we have many different models. We have many different mediation schemes. Anything you want to have, you get it. And now we can see what the LHC will tell us, because at the end it will be the LHC, hopefully the LHC, that judges about this. So the future. The future, of course, is the same as we had it 25 years ago, actually. So this is, again, the statement, which I hope will become wrong. So meanwhile, of course, one might guess what might happen. And I'm coming now to the second part of my talk, where in some way I want to discuss, which is a personal guideline, what the picture of supersymmetry is. And I will be guided by simplicity. I will take some motivation from grand unification and some theoretical input from string theory. So I will now just, in a way, set up a scheme from string theory where we might be able to say what LHC might give and what we would expect in the best of all worlds. Of course, the questions for string theory is that we can ask the question, what actually can we learn from strings for particle physics? And we also have to decide whether we can incorporate particle physics within the framework of string theory. There will be some talks in the conference, also by Stuart Rabi and Michael Ratz about that. There has been some recent progress in explicit model building and also in modelized stabilization and supersymmetry. Mediation schemes in string theory, as I told you, is dilaton modulus dimination. That's the old one. But sometimes, even this does not give soft breaking terms. And then actually, you have to think about radiative corrections on top of it to give you the soft breaking terms. And that's something which, in the simplest case, actually, is what is known as anomaly mediation. So there is some transport of SUSY breaking terms from the hidden sector to the observable sector, and it's given by the beta functions of the MSSM. This is very simple. It might not be the dominant contribution, but it's something which in its parameters is given by the MSSM. So if this is something which we can see, we can feel that this is the MSSM. It only has been realized recently that actually the mechanism to adjust the cosmological constant is very important. And that actually this sector, which is relevant for the adjustment of the cosmological constant, is might be very relevant for the soft Susan frame. Basic question is the origin of the small scale, stabilization of moduli, and now I will concentrate on this question because these moduli typically are massless fields that have been stabilized, and they have to do with some string theory. And in fact, there has been some decisive progress in the year 2003 by Kachu, Kalosh, Linde, and Trevidy, which in some way known as KKLT, which took this very seriously and went through it till the end, including this, what they call the uplifting mechanism, which was the cancellation of the cosmological constant. So in such a scheme, typically what we have sometimes fluxes, which fix the moduli, and we have a Gay-Jinot condensate, as we had before, and we have broken supersymmetry, and we have a superpotential, which looks that it has a constant term, something which comes from the fluxes, and then it has a Gay-Jinot condensate, which we write as the exponential of minus x. So if something is rather small, it determines the Kravitino mass, then x has to be moderately large, and in fact, x is the logarithm of the hierarchy. So if you take M Planck over M 3 half, you take the logarithm, you get this number which you are supposed to get here, which I call the little hierarchy. This has nothing to do with the little hierarchy problem. I call it the little hierarchy. In fact, it turns out that in these schemes, the modulus mediation is suppressed by this factor. And this factor turns out to be 4 pi squared. X is 4 pi squared. And it means that 1 over 4 pi squared is something like a loop factor. So what you actually get here is you have a modulus mediation, but on top of it, you have radiative corrections, and they're of the same order of magnitude. And for reasons will I explain in a minute, I will call this mirage. So the little hierarchy comes in two ways. It actually means that the moduli are heavy by this factor 4 pi squared compared to the Kravitino mass, and the Kravitino mass is heavy compared to the soft terms by the same factor again. The moduli and the Kravitino are heavy, and as we will see later, the Gay-Jinot mass spectrum is compressed. Now, mirage mediation, I will just explain the name, is a contribution for modulus mediation, which is the three-level mediation, but suppressed by this factor 4 pi squared, and the one from the anomaly, which is proportional to the beta. So actually now you get two contributions, and you see in the beta function in the MSSM is sometimes positive, sometimes negative. And if you have a sum, if that would be the only contribution, the sign of the Gay-Jinot mass does not play a role. But here in the sum it plays a role. So in fact we'll get this contribution, we can add and can subtract. If you look at the evolution of the coupling constant, we assume, let's say, a picture like that in the usual grand unified theory. These are the coupling constants. And then we also know the Gay-Jinot masses run in a similar way. But now the Gay-Jinot masses are split at the gut scale because the anomaly mediation, the beta functions are different. They are split by the beta functions. They also run with the beta functions. And so they have to meet at a point. And what happens in such a scheme is that the Gay-Jinot masses, and also in the simplest scheme, the other parameters, they will also meet at a scale. In this case, it's the intermediate scale. In some other cases, it could be even to smaller values or to bigger values. And you see, the smaller this mirage scale is, the more compressed the Gay-Jinot mass pattern is. Because the Gay-Jinot, you see, the Cluino, for example, which is usually the heaviest in this scheme, is not so heavy compared to the others. This will become So what we'll have is that we have the Gaugino masses, they coincide, let's say, above the gut scale or at the string scale. We have these thresholds at the gut scale, and then they meet at the mirage scale, which is some intermediate scale. We have this, I define this parameter rho, which is the ratio of the contributions of the modulus and the anomaly. And we can then write Gaugino masses in the following way, where rho going to zero corresponds to pure anomaly. Now looking at this picture, this is now gravitino mass versus rho. The allowed region is the green region. For a small rho, we have tachyons, which we typically have in mirage mediation. In some cases, the blue one, we have a wrong LSP, and the other bound comes from the 100, from the left Higgs mass bound. And the region rho, 5, etc. is allowed, which is actually amazing, because this scheme only has two parameters, whereas even the M-super, the small one, has four. So for large tangent beta, you have a similar picture. So I could, how much time do I still have?
10 minutes.
Okay, I'll skip this. Sorry about that. Let me say some, there are a few explicit schemes. One of them, and that's where this...
Oh, 20 minutes.
Okay. So the difference, so there is this scheme of KKLT, which is some uplifting via the free brains. Don't mind if you, anti-D free brains actually, don't mind if you don't know that. The point is in this case, rho, this parameter was 5, because it was actually quantized in the scheme in some way, and the mirage scale is a function of 10 to the 11 GeV. So this is actually the picture here. You see this, that is the scale. And here you see rho equal to 5 is actually consistent. So it could have gone wrong, but it worked. And the scheme actually leads to pure mirage mediation. The Gaugino masses and also the scalar masses both meet at the common mirage. So that's something which you should keep in mind. And that seems to be, you see, we have modulus mediation. We could have anomaly mediation, but we can also have this mixture. And this mixture turns out to be rather different. And it comes from the fact that the beta functions are positive and negative, and therefore you get this specific scheme. So these are the constraints of rho. There are other explicit schemes where you do not do it with anti-D free brains. You can have some matter superpotential. This also can give rise to the mirage scale, but there typically it only happens for the Gaugino masses. The scalar mass spectrum, whenever you worked in model building, much more model-dependent than the Gaugino. It's usually very difficult to get the Gaugino masses because they are forbidden at tree level in the renormalizable theory. But once you get them, the prediction is rather robust. So the soft scalar masses here might be dominated by modulus mediation, but the Gaugino masses still might keep. So this is, again, this is a constraint on the mixing parameter. Here, I've plotted it. So in some cases, you will have, of course, the Cluino to be the LSP. So the thing to the left is all ruled out. Here, this is ruled out because of the Higgs mass. And this brownish region here is the region where the thermal abundance of the LSP is consistent with the W bound. Below it here, it is too small, and here is too large. So it also can accommodate the correct terminal abundance. So what I showed here is the mu parameter, which you have to get. So if you would be at rho equal to 5 somewhere here, you would have to put a mu parameter of 300 GeV. This has to do, for those who know, with this little MSSM hierarchy problem. So something here, this is not a serious problem. You actually also see here, this is where you have an Higgsino LSP, this is a mixed, and this is when the Pino LSP comes out. So these are pictures which you get here typically. This is a picture for large tangent beta, again the same thing. And here, for the large tangent beta, you see better this trip, which is consistent with WMAP, and those who work on that, they of course can see immediately where these things come. So I guess we have these schemes, and I sometimes call this a relaxed mirage mediation. That is rather common. The main message here is that the predictions for the Gaugino masses are more robust than for the other soft parameters. I skip this, and now I come to the third part of my talk, is what actually will happen when we turn on LAC. Because we have all these 100,000 models of supersymmetry, and they all give you a spectrum, and the LAC will not give us 100,000 answers in the first year, and we have to see what will happen. Now, first of all, LHC is a machine where we scatter photons and protons, which are strongly interacting particles. It's not like E plus and E minus. And the LHC is that's a machine to produce strongly interacting particles. Now, if Tef scale supersymmetry is the physics there, then it could very well be that the LHC will become a Cluino factor. What we need is, of course, that the Cluino is light enough. If it's too heavy, even LAC will not help us very much. And then you will have a Cluino. Very often in these schemes, the Cluino is lighter than the squarks. And therefore, the Cluino will cascade down to the chargeinos and neutralinos and the quarks. And if the simplest picture works out, then at the end, you will have some missing energy in terms of the NSP neutralino. So once something is produced at the LHC, which looks like a Cluino, we can look at the cascade. Of course, there is this question that some people might say, this is not a Cluino, this is the first Kaluza-Klein excitation of the gluon. And then we have to argue and try to figure out what actually is correct. So I guess that will be the first questions we have to answer once we get some results, hopefully positive results of the LHC. So as I told you, the gate genome masses are very robust in its predictions. So the first, and we will have a Cluino factory, and we will also have the hope to get from the missing energy the mass, or at least you see an estimate of the mass of the LSP. So then it would be good to see what are the gate genome. Now let's now assume the simplest scheme, the low energy particle content of the MSSM and the measured value of the gauge coupling constant. So we have here G1 squared, G2 squared, G3 squared, they are measured at the TV scale and their ratio is 1 to 2 to 6. That's measured. Nothing you can do about. If you then have the particle content of the MSSM, you run them up, they may meet at 10 to the 16 GeV. That's the usual picture of the SUSY. So these are formally for the gate genome masses. You should not look at it. The only thing you should take care of is that they are all given in MA over GA squared. That's the important thing. And that's that the evolution of the gate genome masses at one loop is the same as that of the gauge coupling. So that is in this picture, MA over GA squared does not run at one loop. There are corrections to it, but higher, but the bottom line is at one loop. That is good. So first of all, from the soft breaking terms, the gate genome masses are pretty simple. And secondly, we have this running, which is tied with the gauge coupling constant. So therefore, now we will discuss three characteristic mass patterns which appear in this scheme. The first one is the Sucre pattern. We assume that's the simplest scheme. Universal gauge genome masses at the gut scale. And we assume, let's say, dilaton domination or something like that. So we will then have, at the gut scale, M1 is equal to M2 is equal to M3. They run down, and at low energies, it will be 1 to 2 to 6. So that means that the LSP is predominantly a B-norm. Yeah, it's the M1 here. And the ratio G of the Cluino to the LSP is 6. So if that happens, that would be something where you would say that's supersymmetry. Because that's the simple thing you can get, consistent with grand unification, universal masses at large scale, which is the rather simple scheme. So that will, in a certain way, beat. If you would say, well, one of them is the Kaluza-Klein excitation of the gluon, the other one is the Kaluza-Klein excitation of the photon, which is produced, it will be very hard to come up with a model to get 6 to 1 in this case. Of course, this is at the TV scale here. When we run them down, we actually get the relation 3.3 to 1 to 9. So here what we get is that, you see, the Vino is the LSP. Of course, there might be a mixture with the Xeno in many cases, but I'm just discussing the simplest case here. But what we see here is that the Cluino to LSP ratio, in fact, is 9 to 1. So this is even more distant. Now, the problem with anomaly mediation is known. It's in its pure form, it's inconsistent because the skeptomer masses are tachyon. But as we say, the fermion masses, the scalar masses, are more model dependent. There are ways to solve that problem without saying something about the Gaijin. So that's the second scheme, which is rather simple. The first scheme is the mirage pattern, which we have discussed before. We have a contribution both from anomaly and a suppressed contribution from modulus. If modulus is there full, it always beats the anomaly mediation, and then this is a small correction. But if this is suppressed by this factor 4 pi squared, then of course these things become competitive. For rho equal to 5, as you have seen before, we get actually this mass relation of wave 1 to N2 to N3 is more like that. And for rho equal to 2, they will have the same mass at the weak scale, at the TEF scale. But of course that's something which in model building is rather difficult to achieve because things might go wrong, including having a Cluino LSP. So this mirage scheme still leads to the Bino as the LSP, and the ratio of the Cluino to the LSP is less than 6. So that doesn't smell that simple because you have this parameter rho, but at least in some way it's still something which you can look at, and it actually gives us a compact Bayesian mass pattern. So these are the uncertainties. I should stress that, of course, I only discuss the simple patterns. There are other things which could come up and destroy these patterns in a way that we don't find them. If we have, at a large scale, some big string threshold corrections which completely split up the Gaijino masses in a way that we cannot control, of course, we can just measure them at low energies and then later find out what the scheme is. So, let me come to the end. I want you to keep in mind that Gaijino masses are in some way the simplest things which we'll get when we do supersymmetric models. It partially comes from the fact that there are not so many sources for it and that it's very hard to do it. So typically what you will get in modulus mediation that you will have this F function, this gauge kinetic function F, which multiplies this WW, which is the W alpha, W alpha, which is the gauge, which is the chiral superfield, which contains the Gaijino as the lowest member. And F is a function of the moduli, and when this F has a non-trivial vacuum expectation value, then it breaks supersymmetry, the F component, and it also gives Gaijino masses. If this is suppressed, the modulus mediation, then the simplest next example is anomaly mediation. And it can, of course, the suppression, sometimes people want to make large hierarchies. Some particles, very heavy, 10 to the 10 GeV, and others TeV. That's very difficult to achieve. Typically, the best suppression which you get is that 1 over 4 pi squared. So if we have modulus suppression, it will not be gone completely. Typically, we will have some sign of it for radiative corrections, and we get a mixture of 3-level and loop contributions. So that's, in a certain way, the message. Either we have the dominant modulus mediation, or we have a mixture of some loop corrections. And hopefully these loop corrections are in such a way that they are controlled, like in anomaly. If that's true, then we can work. So let me conclude at this point that I think, and I want to emphasize again, that the Gaijino masses are a promising tool for early tests of supersymmetry at the LHC. Of course, once something has established, you will look at all the data and you can look at a lot of other things. But I guess now we are looking forward and we want to see at the beginning what goes on. Rather robust predictions for the Gaijino masses. We have this simple pattern. And I think the first what could happen is that we could be able to measure the Cluino to LSP ratio G to see whether this is the first sign of supersymmetry, and whether that also tells us already something about the scheme which we are thinking about. And that will ultimately tell us the fate of supersymmetry, and also let's hope that also the conference series lasts rather long, because that might be a good sign. Thank you very much.
Thank you.